Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. All is well.
Excellent. Well, let me just play something one of our listeners made for us here.
I actually recognize that voice.
Well,
oh my.
I'm not sure if our listener wants us to reveal his identity, but I know his first name. So, Jack, thank you very much. That's hilarious. I love it. And so, maybe we might incorporate a couple of times into this intro.
Oh, cool. Fabulous. All right. That's fun.
All right. Well.
All right. What are we up to?
Today, we've got a couple of questions that have to do with codependency, child attachment styles, and advice to parents on losing a child. So we're just going to go straight from there. And if we can get through all of them, we're also going to get a question in about your opinion on excessive cell phone use and whether or not you think that's addictive. And then we're going to get to music
all right.
too. So we're going to try to power through them and see, but we'll see what happens. All right. So dear Dr. Lyle, can you speak on codependency and narcissism? Many sources I've heard recommend that spouses that escape a narcissistic spouse need therapy and support on codependency. The thinking is this tolerance and coping tendencies began in childhood with trauma and ultimately need to heal. If this is wrong thinking, can you recommend some strategies for healing from an abusive marriage, say books or any other information?
Our friend Jack will appreciate this. Yeah, it's all wrong, what everybody's thinking. There is no wound in childhood that's causing any of this. Here's what's happening. Think instead of codependency, which is a fancy word that I suppose means something, just think agreeable, okay? So this makes it much simpler to talk straight. And instead of narcissism, we can just call it disagreeable. So can Dr. Lyle speak on agreeable and disagreeable? And in narcissism, we would call it very disagreeable. So the notion is that if anybody escapes a very disagreeable spouse, then they need therapy and support on their agreeability. No, they don't. They don't need any such thing. So this agreeability did not begin in childhood as a result of some wound or bending their psychology to deal with a pain-in-the-neck parent or abusive parent or anything else under the sun. None of this is true. Now, how can I be so definitive? Easy. Monozygotic twin studies where the twins are raised apart. So we know that there is neither an imitation of personality characteristics from childhood to adulthood. In other words, you don't imitate anybody in your environment, or adoptive children would correlate with their adopted parents on personality dimensions, which they do not. They also don't correlate negatively either. So a psychodynamic view would be that if you had a very abusive parent, then you might become very codependent in order to deal with that, and then you might carry that on and then, of course, repeat this in future relationships, because this was the sort of prototype of how it is that you learn about men or learn about women, you know, from watching your parents or interacting with your parents. Now, I'm making fun of this, and I don't mean to. If we were in the early 20th century or mid-20th century and we didn't know any better, this would be a completely reasonable molding or melding between psychodynamic and learning theory. And that's some middle ground between psychodynamic and learning theory is kind of the way most psychologists think these days. They just sort of think in a fuzzy-headed fashion about the development of personality characteristics and people's, quote, coping strategies or behavioral styles and relationships. What they don't do is they don't see the effect of the genes. And yet, if we actually look at the scientific evidence, the effect of the genes are massive, and they're sitting right in front of us. We just have to know to where to look for the evidence. Now, so by stripping away this notion of codependency and narcissism, we now strip it down to the fact that some poor sap who is a really sweet person, let's call them, for those of us that haven't heard my way of describing the agreeable, disagreeable dimension before, I want you to think personality characteristics fall on bell curves, and I want you to think of dead center of the bell curve with, on the left-hand side of the bell curve, think of disagreeable, very disagreeable. As you get out to the far end tail of it, say the last 5% of it, we could actually use a word called narcissism. As we go to the far other side of the curve, we're going to call those sweethearts, sweet people, very nice, extremely nice, and if you want to call it codependent, I suppose you could. The people that I've ever heard describe themselves as codependent tend to me to not be, quote, they're not that sweet. They are often manipulative, have a secret little disagreeable streak in there where they're looking to manipulate our opinions of them for their own interests. So people that tend to call themselves codependent are not. Now, but there's an awful lot of sweet people out there, and those sweet people are the people that wind up in long-term relationships with disagreeable narcissists. What happens here? But what happens is that when you get out of one of these things, you are, if you manage to, which is like a miracle, so some bizarre set of events takes place and a person actually winds up out of one of these things. If that's true, then what will happen is that they will be in a situation where they certainly don't want to walk back into something like this again. And yet they have recognized that they are actually vulnerable. And so God help them if they run into a psychologist, because a psychologist is going to start explaining to them about how they've been childhoodedly, you know, haywired as a result of some assaults to their psyche when they were young or some such thing. And they're going to be just chasing their tail with a bunch of worthless conversation and confusion. What is the issue? The issue is that they happen to fall on the right-hand side of the bell curve on the agreeable-disagreeable dimension. And so as a result of that, let's suppose that right down the middle, you would conceptually think of this as 50-50, like an average person would be a 50-50 trader. But we know that this isn't true. We know that the average human being is, in fact, more like a 55-45 trader. In other words, they tilt the scale 10% in their own interest. So instead of 50% of the pie, it feels better to them to get about 10% more than they would normally have coming to them. So 55% feels fair to them. There's a whole host of research on this. We could have 1,000 citations that would point to this over and over again. But all you have to do is watch the NBA for about 6 minutes. So just turn it on, even if you've never seen the game before, you're going to find every call somebody's going to be complaining. And you know, it's just not fair. They're just so outraged at how the referee is abusing them. Now, and it's going to turn out that all you have to do is just talk to sports fans about how their team is being treated, and the sports fan will tell you that their team is just consistently mistreated by the referees, and they're just so disgusted. But they're not so disgusted that they're not willing to watch the game, because after all, it's only about 10% loaded against us, And if we, you know, the heroes in white or blue or green or whatever the color is of their jerseys, that those, the good guys, you know, can just overcome the referee bias against them, then, you know, and we win, then that's grand. But if we lose, you know, we probably lost because the referees stole the game from us. This is how human beings think. And so this is telling you that there's all kinds of data showing that people remember people that owe them money more than they remember, you know, who they owe money to. You know, just little things like this. And we're going to have people in the listening audience saying, oh, that's not true of me. I can remember that time when I forgot all about that money. Well, I'm sure that there is truth that we've got a few listeners out there at the tail end of the bell curve that are that have really dysfunctional memory systems, and they remember much better who they owe than who owes them. But it's going to turn out to be the case that that is the unusual human nervous system, that the typical human nervous system beautifully remembers who owes them better than who they owe. Now, this is all to say that the human being's concept of what is dead on fair is actually not dead on fair. It's 55-45 tilted their direction. Now, this is so that they don't get out negotiated when it comes to conflicts of interest in the village. So if you've got a little edge to you that you're snarling just a little bit, then you're not going to get taken advantage of nearly as often. It's a better evolutionary strategy than having a dead-on fair chip. This is clearly the case because that is what has evolved, you know, in human evolution, the evolution of personality. Now, it's going to turn out that you can imagine that bell curve. I don't know that anybody's actually charted this out, and it's my concept that you could delineate along the disagreeable dimension the concept of what the deal needs to look like in order for it to feel fair to you. So you can imagine that somebody else was a 60-40 trader. So they are a little more disagreeable than average, and therefore they need, if it's 60% their way and 40% for the other person, then that feels 50-50 to them. Now, I got friends like this that think that they are very fair and reasonable, and the truth is that I can sniff that they're 60-40 traders. There's a reason they're friends of mine, and that's because they're very talented, and they've got a lot of brains, and they got a lot of give, but it doesn't matter. They're still, I can smell 60-40 all over them. And if they ever listen to this, they know who they are. And Nate has met them both, okay? Now, they'll remain nameless. Now, the thing is that you can imagine as we go down the bell curve, as we continue to go to the left, that there's going to be people that are going to be 80-20 traders, not very many of them. It's very dysfunctional to be an 80-20 trader because you are feeling irritated all the time. Everywhere you go, it turns out that the people are just trying to screw you over with the 20-80 deal, because that when it's a 50-50 deal, when it's an objectively 50-50 deal, if you're an 80-20 trader, it seems outrageously loaded against you. And so these people are chronically irritated, angry, you know, a high percentage of the hours of their life, just because they believe that they are being, you know, mistreated, underappreciated, underpaid, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is, as we head out that direction, that's what a narcissist is. And narcissist isn't some special dimension to be uncovered by psychology that can't be found in the factor analysis of the Big Five. It's right there, okay? It's disagreeable. Now, on the other side of the equation, we're going to have a 28-day trader who's just a sweetheart. And it's going to turn out that it's not very common that 50-50 traders get hooked up with 80-20 narcissists. Because if you're a 50-50 trader coming from the middle of the bell curve or so, somewhere nearby there, then the 80-20 trader is going to be consistently irritating as hell. And they're going to be constantly pushing you to accept a 20-80 deal because that's what feels fair to them. And you're just going to finally get sick of it. And it's going to irritate you, and you're going to have a bunch of arguments about what's fair, and you're going to leave. Okay, now what's going to happen is, if you ever see a narcissist in a long-term relationship, there's an exceedingly good chance that the person on the other side of this is a 20-80 trader, an unbelievable sweetheart. So right now, my lovely 85-year-old mother is sitting here listening to me. I'm at her kitchen table. And My dad, bless his heart, Ralph, was quite disagreeable. Now, he wasn't 80-20. He was about 65-35. And my mother is about a 30-70. So as a result, they rarely had conflicts because she would just give. It didn't seem unreasonable to her, even though to my sister and I, we're looking at her like, what's wrong with you? It's totally unreasonable. And, you know, the household ran just fine. The only anger that ever came at the household was Ralph. But when that 65-35, you got a little bit of pushback from somebody, and then we would see the anger emerge. So this is how it is that this works. If it turns out that you, quote, get out of one of these relationships, however, is that you escape because you are the 20-80 traitor on the other side of a full-on narcissist, then the truth of the matter is you don't need any help to heal anything. Just breathe the free air and try to learn about this dimension, and let's, you know, don't make the same mistake twice, for God's sakes. Look for the clues. The clues are a constant, chronic, repetitive irritability. That's the telltale footprints in the snow that you can't miss. People that are nice people aren't angry very often. And so that this is going to show you, it isn't that they can't get angry once in a while or irritated once in a while, but if it's a chronic, ongoing, cyclical issue, and God forbid they ever turn it on you when you're a sweetheart and everybody in the world thinks you're more than fair, then that's the problem. You don't need any therapy. You just need to find the right environment, i.e. a decent person. So you can imagine that if a nice, solid 55-45 trader won't have any problems with some 20-80 sweetheart. Where's the mathematical conflict of interest? It's just not going to be there. The 55-25 is happy to take 55. Seems like everything's fair. The 20-80 trader is getting 45. They're getting a 45-55 deal, and they're like, wow, this is really a nice person. I really like this person. Good. That's the therapy that you needed. Therapy you needed was an environmental change away from an ass. And a book that can help you with this is called How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. You don't need to heal from an abusive marriage. You just need to not repeat it. That's the therapy is the good life that you have in front of you. All right. Next, let's go on to the next one.
Excellent. Okay, yeah, next one. Well, I had a little follow-up question that had to do with your agreeable dimension. And I was just thinking, I was curious if the subjectivity of the agreeable-disagreeable bell curve with respect to each person may explain why higher conscientious people who have the intelligence gravitate towards engineering. And my thinking was because with the math, you can show exact fairness. And I wonder if that has anything to do with
that. That is really interesting thinking. That's very interesting. It's quite possible that the objectivity of mathematics may be comforting to a extremely conscientious individual. Fascinating. Good thinking. Never quite thought of that before, and we'll have to kick that around. Good job.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, let's go on to the next question.
Sure.
And next question has to do again with the difference between evolutionary psychology and the standard psychology thinking. So, dear Dr. Lyle, are children's attachment styles bogus in predicting their personalities? Also, what's the earliest age that you can see a person's personality characteristics? Can you tell if a two-year-old is open to experience agreeable, disagreeable, etc.?
I don't know the research on this topic. However, this is what I – first of all, the idea of attachment styles is – let's sort of transform and let's look through the telescope through the right, lens. The attachment theory goes way back to John Bowlby, goes back to the 1930s, et cetera, and it has psychodynamic sorts of roots in it. It's actually incorrect fundamentally. The notion is that early childhood attachment the quality, the attachment, the security, the attachment, et cetera, is impactful in human personality development. That is the underlying theory in attachment theory, and some of this was born out of the the extreme deprivations that were seen in when kids are orphanages. So this is I suppose, and I don't doubt that it's the case, that if you take an infant and put it in a bed and never talk to it and touch it for a couple of years, I think that it's very likely that there's some significant impact on that. So we're not going to say that there's no process by which an environmental set of inputs could not potentially influence personality. If you put someone in an extraordinarily extreme situation that is inconsistent with the natural history of the organism and it survives, then I'm not shocked that there may be fallout from that. Now, I'm going to bet that that was oversold, and I bet if we went back and looked at that research today where the world's a little bit wealthier and there's just enough people around, milling around, that we no longer could, not in the first world, have a deprivation situation that would be as rough as maybe some of those deprivation situations were. Now, but this aside, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that the people's attachment process that they're going through in almost all cases is normal with respect to the species. In other words, they're growing up around people that give a damn about them, most likely their parents. It could be an adoptive parent who might wind up being quite ambivalent about what it is that they took on after all the poop and the squalling and all the problems. But nevertheless, the kid is getting normal interactions with members of its species, and it's developing as it's going to develop. Now, so the notion that the nature of that development is going to have a significant impact on adult personality turns out to be false. What is going to be true is going to be the fact that the kid's personality is emerging even as a young person, and you're going to be able to see it. So this is the correlation coefficients that have been observed by attachment theorists that have reasonably and sensibly got them very excited in the early days of this. So, of course, you would be fascinated and hopeful and then create a literature that would have people very much afraid of putting their children at risk for not being able to attach and not being able to love fully and not be able to commit to a marriage and not be able to be a good mom or good father, not be able to really, you know, et cetera. Because if an attachment theorist would say, wow, the kid's not attached well, this is like critical and unbelievably important, and if it isn't done really well here in the first 2 or 3 years, oh my God, then, you know, this person, it's like a battery that gets messed up when you're recharging it. Like, oh, if you don't recharge it all the way, you know, when you do it the first time, then you mess up the internal architecture of this thing, and it can ever only be charged halfway the rest of its life. Okay? Not true with the human personality at all. But what they were observing was something real. And that what they were observing was individual differences in personality emerging right before their eyes, even early. But nobody in the tank, nobody anywhere in this theory, was thinking that what they were observing was individual variations in genetics. Okay, that is what they were observing. And so those things can be shown. I mean, I've been around little kids that have grown up. I can see it. Okay, now I don't know the literature on this subject, but they are different, and very often they are reliably different pretty early. So a 2-year-old that is pleasant, happy-go-lucky, and agreeable, and plays nice with its friends, you know, might look quite a bit different. I'll bet you if we took 50 of those and took 50 that were biting and kicking and screaming and all that, and I'll bet you that there's a pretty strong correlation coefficient 20 years later as to what those things look like. So no shock that things are emerging. Intelligence is becoming obvious very quickly early. intelligence can be fairly reliably measured at 6 months old, okay, and quite reliably measured at 3 years old. So this is it would be no shock given the fact that that's true. It would be a big surprise if it was not also true for personality. I don't know that any developmental psychologist is looking at the assessment of the Big Five longitudinally, you know, starting with some kind of assessment of the Big Five early in the game at, say, 2 years old or earlier. Now, if you understand why nobody would be that interested in such research, because all it's saying is, hey, it's in the genes anyway. So therefore, the whole process of panicking over the developmental process means we can just quit funding these grants because no longer do we give a damn because we know it's not making any difference. So you can see that there's probably a considerable reticence in developmental psychological research to holding the light of the truth on this particular question. If I'm wrong, I apologize, but I will bet that the zeitgeist of modern developmental psychology in this arena is not being dominated by behavior genetics. So that is certainly, I had a report from a student at UC Berkeley that was there in the last 2 years that told me, no way is behavior genetics front and center. It's actually snarled at from the side and is treated in a hostile fashion. So I don't know if Berkeley's typical, but you know it should be a citadel of academic excellence in this arena, and it is not. So that's what I think is probably happening out there. But anyway, the long and short of the answer to that question is that, you're watching personalities emerge. It's probably, can you tell if a two-year-old's open to experience? Probably could if somebody would bother to develop standardize a device in order to test it. I have no doubt that they could figure that out. And it wouldn't take much to tell agreeable, disagreeable, and everything else. But, you know, we'll see. The marshmallow experiment that was so famous, done by Walter Mischel, that for a while was thought to be a device to actually help people become conscientious and successful in the future, turns out to be, of course, nothing other than an early demonstration of conscientiousness and intelligence. So in any event, enough of that question. The answer is yes, you can see those characteristics early. And attachment theory, the general concept, attachment styles make some sense only insofar as they correlate with the variables of the Big Five.
Hold on. I'm just swallowing all the marshmallows I couldn't handle. I had to eat them all. They're just too tasty.
All right. There
all
you
right.
go.
Okay. Yeah, I always wondered if we've talked about why evolutionary psychology isn't accepted at all in many of these things. And I wonder if it's maybe the conscientiousness of the academics where they're essentially overestimating the worst case scenario, where now if we start believing that, you know, people are the way they are, shocker, that bad people can do things that are bad with that information.
I actually don't think so. First of all, I want to clarify something. The evolutionary psychology is a different branch of investigation than behavior genetics. They sound similar, but they're actually not the same thing. Behavior genetics is what it is that we talk about when it comes to personality and the influences that give rise to individual differences. And, of course, my way of thinking and the evidence indicates that genes overwhelmingly dominate the show. Other people would say the evidence is muddier than that. But it turns out that there's ways that you can look at that evidence through a really skewed prism, and you can look at it in a way and believe that the environment has got, you know, a significant influence. To just sidetrack us for a second, let me explain. There, you can pinpoint a huge proportion of the variance in people's personalities to genetics. The rest of it that you cannot pin down anything to. In principle, you could say, oh, well, that's environment. But when you say environment, it might be reasonable to say, well, what in the environment do you think is having any influence on, for example, a child being more conscientious or a child being more intelligent, or a child being more outgoing, or a child being more disagreeable? Like, what experiences or role models or any process from the environment do you believe is having an impact on that? What X can you put in an equation that will predict the Y that you're observing? And they cannot find anything. So it means that you can say, well, genetics does not perfectly predict everything, because two monozygotic twins raised apart or raised together are very similar, but they are not exactly the same individual, and they only correlate 0.62 across the personality dimension. So what happens to the rest of the variance that is not being explained out of that 0.62? The answer is, can be looked at from many different dimensions, but the dimension, I will argue that there's error variance in the tools that we use. I will also argue that the person's understanding of their environment that they're in is actually a informational input that's acting on effectively a fixed mechanism of personality, and the two different people have slightly different understandings about the environments that they find themselves in, or the environments that they find themselves in are slightly different. And so as a result, their decisions and tendencies are somewhat different because they are dealing with slightly different information, even that they've got the same circuits. Okay. So it's like, what happens to two different McDonald's on a given month, you know, selling Shamrock Shakes? Well, one of them is slightly, you know, in a different place. There's more people that are, there's more Irish Catholics that are interested in St. Patrick's Day. And so they wind up going there, and they sell 20% more than the other one. Slightly different environment, even though both those McDonald's have pretty much the same sales on everything else throughout the year. So slightly different environmental circumstances can lead to slightly different differences in behavior, even though the underlying architectural structure of motivation can be identical. Okay, and that's actually not a concept that's thought through very carefully in modern personality theory. Now, there's other issues, which is that even though the genetics are identical, it turns out that in development in embryos, even slight differences in the location, the uterus, et cetera, just the fact that they're different organisms, not exactly the same organism having exactly the same experience, leads to variation. And this is seen in breeding fruit flies in a bottle, that you can have 10,000 of them in there that are genetically identical, but there's quite a bit of variation as they grow. So, but the question is that the environments are effectively have all kinds of random action that's taking place. It's not systematic. When people talk about environmental impact on personality, they are not talking about random, unpredictable environmental processes that cannot possibly pin down anything. No, they're talking about mom was this way and therefore you're that way. Dad was this way, therefore you're this way. This trauma happened to you were 7, therefore that caused you to be this type of a person. That's what people are talking about when they talk about environmental influence on personality development, and there's not a shred of evidence that supports that there's anything significant in that pot of explanations at all. Okay, now, so the God knows, I forget what your question was. I was totally lost.
I was following what you were saying. I think I forgot it too.
I forget. Forget it. Yeah. We lost it.
Okay.
We lost the whole point. All right.
Yeah.
So let's move on. All right. My mom's cracking up. She's used to this. All right. What else we got?
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, what advice would you give to a parent who's lost a child, who's, say, 18 years old, under tragic circumstances such as suicide? Are there any useful techniques or ways of thinking to really help ease the pain of such a profound biological loss?
Great question. Fabulous and hard question. I'm not sure, but I would say the first thing that we do is we need to do a thorough assessment about what our strategy was with the management of, you know, our influence that we had on that life. And we have to think through, obviously, and ruminate, and even get feedback from wise other people about this process to make sure that there's nothing for us that we need to learn. And the mind is going to, let me explain in principle what the mind is up to as a person grieves and then may re-grieve and then go through repetitive cycles of grieving and may have a very hard time letting go of this. The reason why the mind needs to go over and over again losses of great magnitude is because the mind was designed by nature to run cost-benefit analysis on the utilization of its resources in order to optimize survival and reproductive success. That's the job of the mind. That is, in fact, its motivational architecture. So as a result, it has algorithms to make decisions about the utilization of its energy. And so if you lose something as important as a child, if you're a mama puppy, you're not going to worry about it too much because you have a litter of five or six of these things every year. But if you're a human, you're going to worry about it a lot because you don't have very many of them, and every one of them is a jewel. And so as a result, if you lose one, you're designed by nature to think about how much investment you have in a child. It is a phenomenal percentage of your life's energy. And so if one dies or under some tragedy, car accident, illness, suicide, whatever it is, you are built to do a post-mortem analysis to the nth degree to try to figure out, were there any clues? Did I miss something? You know, did I handle it right? What can I learn? The reason is that your mind is going to grind and grind and grind and grind on that problem until it becomes convinced that there's nothing else for it to learn. Okay, that's how it's going to be designed. And so so now that's why it's useful to have wise other people that can step through the process with you and check your logic and give you feedback on that everything that you did was incredibly reasonable. Or maybe it wasn't, okay? Maybe we have to look at where there was a little window where there was some clue or some procedure that we didn't do right. We had seen that the kid was drinking and seen that he was driving, and he'd actually drive drunk three times, and we were embarrassed about it, and we talked to him about it, but we didn't take away the car, okay? And that was a mistake, and et cetera. So in other words, we have to look at this thing and be honest and unmerciful in that analysis so that we make sure that our brain starts to figure out that we have nothing left to learn. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to shut off that analysis, because it may always feel like there's something left to learn because there was so much lost that it's still worth some time to circle back around there and check one more time, okay? Now, what can we do about this if a person particularly, what can be unfortunate, if you have a person that's very high conscientiousness and therefore, would be a ruminator anyway? So a person that would spend an awful lot of energy grinding on the worst-case scenario, then a worst-case scenario happens, and now that sort of fuse or cycle is lit pretty easily, and it can be hard for them to put a distance behind a loss. Now, one of the things that was suggested by a clinician that I respect is that you can possibly have decision rules for when you are going to spend that time. So you may be able to essentially coax your mind into saying, you know what? It's Saturday morning. You know what I mean? Saturday morning is when I'm going to think about this. And I'm going to think about it I'm going to take a walk, and I'm going to think about this between 9 and 10 a.m. after breakfast. And then I'm not going to think about it again until next Saturday. That sort of thing. And in other words, the ritualization of focus of attention. That may convince the mind to say, I don't have to keep thinking about it right now because I will be circling back to this and making this the focus of my attention later. And I've got it on a schedule. Okay? So that may be a useful technique to try to ease the pain of a profound loss.
Wow, thank you.
Okay.
All right, well, we've got time for a couple of questions that we did not have on the show description. And
sure.
Just to let our listeners know, I read every single one of the questions. We are a little bit of backlogged, so just keep sending the questions. I love your questions. This question is about maybe 100 episodes ago, the episode about the future.
Yeah.
So, dear Dr. Lyle, how would you describe excessive cell phone usage? In your episode about the future, Dr. Lyle, you said overuse of our cell phone is not an addiction, and I was surprised. I realized people use their cell phones for different reasons, like checking news feeds or checking social media. But either way, I feel like conversations are interrupted when people pause mid-sentence to check their phones. What impact will these constant distractions have on us long-term? Do you think it's harmful that we can't stay focused for a sustained period of time?
Okay. Let's look at this now. Couple of things. First of all, I doubt that there's the slightest bit of evidence that can be shown that there's been any change in the ability of human beings to focus their attention. So, in fact, I would bet at all that there's no such evidence. Now, the thing is that doesn't mean that people aren't more quick to shift their focus of attention to something that's more interesting. But that's a whole different story than saying that they're losing the ability to focus their attention. I don't notice people are watching a big football game that means something to them that they're unable to focus their attention on the football game. I don't notice some guy out with a hot girl that's across from him that he's trying to get laid. He's having any problem, not looking at his cell phone. So what you're seeing here is that all behavior is being driven by cost-benefit analysis. And so what we're finding is that the cell phone is a vector for information to come in from all different sources that is interesting, and it can be competing very favorably with whatever it is that you've got in front of you. So when I'm at the car wash, believe me, I don't want to sit and talk to the guy next to me about what's on the TV as Oprah's up there and she's saying something, and it's like I couldn't care less. So as a result, I'm going to be looking at my cell phone and seeing what interesting things are going on in the world. So this is no problem at all. The what would I say about anything else about this? It's actually curious to me that we haven't had any major rise in auto accidents. I'm astounded that this is true, given that the cell phones are around and texting and all that sort of thing. Shows you that as enticing as this is, and as it is to break the law and look at your cell phone, et cetera, it's actually people's survival capabilities are remarkably good, and they're able to actually do an incredibly good job at shifting their attention on a moment's notice. It's incredible, actually. So I actually don't think that this is a problem. I think what do I think about it? I actually think that just like with a lot of media, there's things come with as a two-edged sword. So I can remember as in my youth, I can remember that the television was seen as the big evil, and that the television was this sort of addictive-like thing, and kids watch 6 or 8 hours a day or some such thing, and how terrible this is. Now, is it terrible? No, it's not terrible, but it is a supernormal stimuli that can bias human action away from things that might be more authentic with Stone Age programming inside the machine. So in other words, better to go out and kick the football than watch somebody else kick the football. Better to go dance than to watch other people dance. However, it is also the case that there's never been anything like television for educating humans about all kinds of things. And there's probably never been, and there isn't really, any other source of entertainment that has been so vast and so extraordinarily valuable to human beings as television. So is there an underlying cost to this, potentially in individual cases and even on a widespread basis to varying degrees? Of course, that's true. But a world without it? Ridiculous. And the same thing can be said now. All we're seeing is that the cell phone is a little miniature television. It's more than that. It's actually interactive. It enables human beings to reach out across vast distances and to access all kinds of people doing all kinds of interesting things and to be consumers of that information processing. And so that, do I think it's a problem? No. It is if somebody runs into me and wrecks my back or kills me because they didn't use good judgment. But that, you know, that's why it's my job to drive a big car and try to stay off the roads as much as I can. I don't see that this is harmful. I think that just like anything else, certain of these things can get a person out of balance. And I think probably it's not the cell phone per se that I think is probably able to drag life out of balance. It's the notion of pseudo-esteem and the pseudo-esteem processes of social media that are probably the most costly, quietly costly thing that is taking place in the modern generation with modern communication devices, that people are addicted to the process of trying to get pseudo-esteem rather than earning esteem in the right way from the people that matter. And it isn't a disaster for their lives. It's junk food, okay? You can live on junk food, and junk food's exciting, but it's not as healthy as really healthy food. And the same thing is true with the pseudo-esteem processes of the modern social media environment. We can understand it. We can see it. In some ways, it can be extremely valuable because certain ideas can spread like wildfire in a way that they never could before through micro networks. It used to be that you had to have a television show to be heard by a large number of people. Now you don't. And so now you can be anybody with a good idea. You can have an audience and develop a wider microphone. So but probably to me, what I see is a remarkable amount of time and attention and hustle and direction of energies and hurt feelings around pseudo-esteem processes. And that this is the inevitable byproduct of this. And it's going to be with us, and it's going to be with us forever. Beating the genes is about not letting your life leak its energy into a pseudo-esteem process and remain focused on earning esteem in the right way from the people that matter.
Dr. Lyle, fantastic.
It's going to turn out. It's going to get wild. So hold your horses. You might get wild.
There we go,
all
Dr.
Cool.
Lyle.
A lot
Very,
of fun.
A lot of fun. Great show. And we will talk to you at the other end next week.
All right. And thanks to Jack again. Very cool, buddy.
Thank you, Jack. All right. Take
okay.
care, Dr. Lyle. Have a good night, everybody.
All right. You too. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.